From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, James Franco tells us why he decided to direct and star in a film about the making of what some have called the best worst movie ever made, the 2003 film The Room. The Room was written, directed, produced, and financed by Tommy Wiseau, who was also the film's leading man and has a strange, unplaceable accent. Here's one of Wiseau's famous lines.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
That clip that you just played, he's quoting James Dean's film, Rebel Without a Cause, and he's quoting the most famous line from that film, you're tearing me apart. And he put his own spin on it. You're tearing me apart, Lisa.
We'll talk with Franco about playing Wiseau in the new film, which is called The Disaster Artist.
Do you understand life? Do you?
Later, linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us his word of the year. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Franco, has written and directed a new movie called The Disaster Artist that's about the making of the 2003 film The Room. The Room is a movie that's been called the Citizen Kane of bad movies. The Disaster Artist is based in part on a book of the same name about the making of The Room. The co-author, Tom Bissell, describes The Room as a movie made by an alien who has never seen a movie but has had movies thoroughly explained to him. The Room has developed a cult following through midnight screenings around the country. People laugh at how ineptly made it is and how strange the leading man's performance is. That actor, Tommy Wiseau, also wrote, directed, produced, and financed The Room. James Franco plays Wiseau and befriended him during the making of The Disaster Artist. But Wiseau remains a mystery man with an unplaceable accent, which he says is from New Orleans, but is clearly not. Earlier this year, James Franco starred in season one of the HBO series The Deuce, playing two roles, identical twins. We'll talk about that later. Let's start with a scene from the 2003 film The Room. Tommy Wiseau plays Johnny, whose girlfriend Lisa has been cheating on him with his best friend. In this scene, Johnny is upset and deeply wounded because Lisa has accused him of hitting her. He's walking through the door to the roof of his building where he meets his friend Mark.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bull****. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hey, Johnny. What's up?
I have a problem with Lisa. She says that I hit her.
What? Well, did you?
No, it's not true. Don't even ask. What's new with you?
Well, I'm just sitting up here thinking, you know. I got a question for you.
Yeah.
You think girls like to cheat like guys do?
What makes you say that?
I don't know. I'm just thinking.
I don't have to worry about that because Lisa's loyal to me.
Yeah, man, you never know. People are very strange these days.
Now that you've heard that scene from The Room, listen to this scene from The Disaster Artist about shooting that scene. Seth Rogen plays the script supervisor who's directing the scene and has to keep giving Tommy Wiseau his lines because Wiseau can't remember them.
Action!
What line?
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bull****. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Okay.
Action!
What is line?
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bull****. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark. Scene 112, take 13. Mark it. Action.
I did not hit her. Okay. Line.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bull****. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Take 17, action.
I hit her.
No. Do you want to change the line?
Script is script. Script stays same.
You're doing great, man. We'll get there.
Action. 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 Action.
You have to say it loud. I can't hear in here. Say action so I can hear.
Okay.
So that was a scene from The Room and a scene from the new film, The Disaster Artist. James Franco, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, Terry.
So I know
this is my third time.
It is.
I don't remember. This is my third time.
But who's counting? Oh, I'm so glad you remember. So I think a lot of our listeners know The Room, but a lot of our listeners don't. So I'm going to ask you to describe The Room for people who haven't seen it. Like, what's your short version
Sure.
of the description?
Right. Well, first I'll just say my movie, The Disaster Artist, is about the making of The Room, which is an actual movie. It is not the Brie Larson Oscar-winning movie Room. It's something else
right. That
was written and directed by and stars this man named Tommy Wiseau, who also financed it at the tune of $6 million. Now, it does not look like it was made for $6 million. It looks like it was made for about $60. It came out in 2003, and Tommy intended it to be a great drama. He wrote on the original poster that it was a Tennessee Williams-level drama. It's a very simple story. If I told you the plot, it's basically, you know, Tommy casts himself as this guy, Johnny. Maybe I should say first, the kind of magic behind the room, you know, is due to Tommy Wiseau. There are three mysteries to Tommy. Where he's from, because he sound like this, you know, which suggests like Eastern Europe by way of France and trying, I don't know, maybe dialect coaches and failing at that. But he say he's from New Orleans, he all-American guy. The second mystery is his age. He was at least in his late 40s when he made The Room, but claimed that he was in his 20s. And then where he got the money, the $6 million, which is the darkest mystery. I mean, the other two, you just sort of see through the thin facade. But the money, he claims that he made it, you know, selling denim at his own little shop. And every time I've questioned him about that, he you know, adamantly insists that he made it through selling Levi's jeans. And I'm like, Tommy, come on. You don't know how many jeans I did? He's like, James, you embarrass yourself. You don't know anything about retail. And I'm like, okay. I don't. All right, fine. So anyway, real quick, the plot of The Room is this guy who, oh, by the way, you can look him up online, but he looks sort of like the mix between like a vampire and a pirate and Michael Jackson or something like that. And and he has like long black hair that looks like it's dyed with magic marker. And
has never been washed.
Yes. And so he casts himself as Johnny, this, you know, the great guy, all-American guy. And basically, the plot of the movie is his girlfriend and his best friend have an affair and betray him. And spoiler alert, he commits suicide at the end. And that's kind of it. But that says nothing about all the bizarre, you know, creative decisions, the weird side plots about drug dealers that have that never show up again, mothers-in-law who say they have breast cancer and then never mention it again, you know, just bizarreness. And almost as if some people have described this movie as the best worst movie ever made or the Citizen Kane of bad movies.
So to make your movie about the making of The Room, you had to basically study everything that makes The Room weird and unintentionally funny. The writing, the acting, the edits, the use of music, because you had to reproduce some of it in addition to telling the behind-the-scenes story.
So, yes, but here's the thing.
Yes.
But if all we had was The Room, and we were just sort of like, let's make a movie on that, we would at best probably be able to make a spoof. In fact, what we had was this book, The Disaster Artist, that was written by Greg Sestero, who was the other actor in The Room and Tommy Wiseau's best friend, and also written by this great journalist, Tom Bissell.
Yeah.
Yeah, who is incredible, an incredible writer. And so I think that one of the, you know, the smartest things Greg Sestero ever did was to get Tom to co-write this book with him, because it's an incredible book. And that's actually how I came to this whole project. I read the book right when it came out about 4 years ago. I saw it on the New York Times Book Review, and it's a Hollywood story, but it's unusual and unlike any other. And I love Hollywood stories. And so it's like, before I was halfway done, I was like, oh, this is for me. So that's all to say, we had more than just The Room.
Well, you had even more than that. You had tapes. You had tapes
yes.
that Tommy Wiseau made of
yes.
like his audio journals. Tell us about those tapes.
Okay. Well, so Tommy knows I have them. Okay. So let's just say that up front. Like,
did he give them to you, or did
no? Tommy did not.
How
give
did
them
you
to
get
me.
Them?
Greg gave them to me. So Tommy calls them now the secret tape. I know you have secret tape. So
Can I just stop right there? For people just tuning in, James Franco keeps lapsing in and out of Tommy's accent. So if he occasionally sounds odd to you, that is why. He's going in and out.
Not only am I lapsing into the accent, I almost can't help it. I just, it's sort of like a virus. It's just in me now. But so it'll come out every once in a while. So 20 years ago, 5 or 6 years before he made his magnum opus, The Room, he was in L.A. Trying to make it as an actor, going to acting school. And so he would drive around in his car and talk to himself on a mini tape recorder. And it's amazing material. As an actor, you couldn't ask for anything more. It's as if I had the running inner monologue of the guy I was playing. And in fact, it was even more valuable in this case because Tommy Wiseau is the master rewriter of history. Because when he was making The Room, I think he was completely sincere. He was aiming for Brando and James Dean and came out with something completely different. But when he realized that people were laughing at his film, he then rewrote the whole, you know, his whole script and claimed that
the script of his life, not the script of the movie.
Yeah. Yes. Meaning he came out and said, oh, I intended it to be comedy. Whereas, in fact, he had kept it in theaters on his own dime for 2 weeks to qualify for the Oscars. So he had been aiming for this great dramatic movie. He had said, you know, before, people will see my movie and they will not be able to sleep for 2 weeks. They'd be so disturbed. And but then people laughed at it. And so he then said, yeah, I intended to be comedy. And now what he says about The Room is, you know, The Room is a safe place. You can laugh, you can cry, do whatever you like, express yourself. Just don't hurt yourself. So I couldn't very well go to Tommy now and say, what were you like when you were making The Room? Because he wouldn't give me anything real. You know, he'd just be like, yeah, I intended to be comedy, da, da, da. So these tapes became even more valuable. And they were sort of the truth. Mm-hmm. And it was a time capsule of the man from the time that he was making The Room. Even though the Room resulted in, you know, it was such a kind of wacky, bad, you know, conventionally bad thing, we're showing that the passion behind it is no different than the passion of, you know, of Francis Ford Coppola or of James Dean or me, James Franco. Like, everybody has the same level of passion. It's just that I guess Tommy had zero self-awareness, you know, when he was making it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Franco. He stars in and directed the new movie, The Disaster Artist, which is about behind the scenes of the making of The Room. And it's about mm-hmm. the person who made The Room. The Room is a 2003, like, midnight cult classic film. And he also stars in the HBO series, The Deuce. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Franco, and his latest project is starring in and directing the new film, The Disaster Artist, and he's also in the HBO series, The Deuce. The first season is over, but it's still on demand on HBO. Okay, so I want to play another short scene from The Room. So this isn't James Franco's movie about the making of The Room. This is from The Room itself. And so we're going to hear Tommy Wiseau as Johnny finding out that his girlfriend doesn't want to be with him anymore.
You shouldn't have any secrets from me. I'm your future husband.
You sure about that? Maybe I'll change my mind.
Don't talk like that. What do you mean?
What do you think? Women change their minds all the time.
You must be kidding, aren't you?
Look, I don't want to talk about it. I'm going to go upstairs and wash up and go to bed.
How dare you talk to me like that? You should tell me everything.
I can't talk right now.
Why, Lisa, please talk to me, please. You're part of my life, you are everything. I could not go on without you, Lisa.
You're scaring me.
You are lying. I never hit you. You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
Why are you so hysterical?
Do you understand life? Do you?
I don't know. It's, you know, you can tell somebody's like, why is I was trying somehow to just channel some kind of emotion, but it's all just so out of sync. He doesn't seem to really understand human emotion either as a person, judging from how you portray his story, or as an actor. Tommy just seems like delusional. Do you think he has like a psychological or cognitive disorder? Is that a weird question? Is that okay to ask that?
That's okay to ask me. It's sort of like gets a little tricky because if I thought he was sort of like suffering, you know what I mean? If I thought like, oh man, he needs to be locked away and because he needs serious help, that's something I take very seriously. And I don't think that. I think, you know, he's living his life. He's got a community. He's not hurting anyone and he's not hurting himself. I think, you know, I think he's fine. But yeah, I think he's got a disorder that's sort of on the spectrum that maybe a lot of actors have, that I have to a certain extent, of like thinking, you know, there's this weird thing that happens in Hollywood and probably happens everywhere where it's like, if I make it into the movies, I will be saved. I will be happy. And I think in Tommy's case, because I do think he was a very lonely guy, that one of the things he was seeking with this movie and also making it with his best friend Greg was friendship, a community, love. And I think in a weird way, he got that. When he shows up at these screenings, he does have a community. People are chanting his name. I know what you're going to say, like, yeah, but it's not genuine or whatever. Yeah, he has to do a certain amount of mental gymnastics to translate the laughing and the applause that he gets at those screenings into, like, just pure applause or you know, but it's still something. What happened with my movie at the first screening, the first public screening at South by Southwest, which was also the first time that Tommy ever saw the movie because he didn't want to watch it in private for whatever reason, is we showed it there. It turned out to be an incredible screening, standing ovation. I kept looking down the row at Tommy to see how he was going to react. He was wearing his shades in, you know, while watching the movie. I couldn't tell what he thought of the movie. We went up on stage to do a Q&A after me, my brother, and Seth Rogen. We were hesitant to bring Tommy up because we didn't know what he was going to think. He famously said of the book that our movie's based on, the book only 40% true. And we're like, well, he could very well not like our movie because we based the movie on the book. And, we don't want to have an awesome screening and then have Tommy come up and say, well, yeah, that movie not true and, you know, whatever. And so we didn't bring him up. And then this guy came up from the audience and asked a question. And then he said, oh, by the way, I play the real Chris R. in The Room, which is this just side character, this drug dealer named Chris R. They asked Tommy, like, why is his name Chris R.? Can't we just call him Chris? He's like, no, his name Chris R. He drug dealer, Chris R. I'm like, okay. So he's like, I played the real Chris R. Can I have a picture? And Seth Rogen's like, yeah, dude, come on up here. So Chris R. came up on stage. I look out in the audience at Tommy. He's like 15 rows back, but I can see like this darkness, this dark cloud descending on him. And I still haven't talked to him. I don't know if it's because he's jealous that Chris R. is up there or that he just hated the movie. And so I was like, Tommy, come up. Tommy, come up on stage. And he won't come up. And so then the audience in Austin all stood up and started chanting his name, Tommy, Tommy, and just like in our movie. And he, you know, that's basically what he wanted. So he comes up And we still didn't give him the mic because I still didn't know what he was going to say. And it's my biggest regret. And I step off stage finally and I'm like, all right, Tommy, what'd you think? And he goes, well, yeah, I approve 99.9%. And I'm like, oh, wow. And would you, what's the 0.1%? And you think he's going to say, I never said that or whatever. And he goes, director to director, he goes, yeah, James, I think you should look at lighting and beginning a movie. And I'm like, oh, man, yeah, I'll tell my cinematographer to watch the room for pointers. But then we realize only later that he had been wearing his shades through the whole movie. So it's like, yeah, of course the lighting's off. But here's my big point is I realized in that screen, I only realized later, when they were cheering for him, that they were cheering his story, they were cheering him on and the will it took to get his movie made, because we made Tommy sympathetic. That was our aim in the movie, in my movie, The Disaster Artist. And that was the first time in Tommy's entire life that he heard unadulterated, unironic applause for his story. And that, just thinking about that, it moves me right now to say that. Like, mm-hmm. He got it. He finally got what he wanted.
My guest is James Franco. He directed and stars in the new movie, The Disaster Artist. We'll talk more after a break. And linguist Jeff Nunberg will tell us his word of the year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Pajamagram Company, offering 29 matching holiday pajama styles for the whole family, including cats and dogs, and with Charlie Brown and holiday themes in knits, fleece, and flannel. More at pajamagram.com. And from LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform, committed to helping get work done in today's modern workforce. Learn more at gotomeeting.com.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is James Franco. He directed and stars in the new movie, The Disaster Artist. And if you watched The Deuce, you know he played two characters in that HBO series, which is set in Times Square on 42nd Street in the early 70s, just at the very beginning when the mob is moving in and opening up massage parlors, and when porn is starting to become a little above ground and just not underground and starting to be shown in porn theaters. And you play two characters. One of them is a bartender who gets involved with the mobsters and kind of against his will gets involved with those massage parlors. He doesn't want to be involved in working in the sex trade industry, but he's kind of getting, pushed into it. And you also play his brother,
Frankie,
his identical twin brother, who is kind of happy to get involved with the mobsters because that's where the money is. And he's just a real professional troublemaker. He's a gambler who's always in debt and always in trouble and always looking to his brother Vince to kind of
bail him out.
That's
a great
series.
You watched it.
I really like it. So. So I want to talk to you first a little bit about playing two twin brothers. Yeah. Like, you had to figure out, you and the director had to figure out some distinguishing characteristics so that I, watching it, could tell which character I was watching. Part of it was the clothing, because they dressed a little bit differently. What else did you do as an actor?
Yeah, so when a single actor plays twins, there's a lot of ways you can go. Like, you can make them, their look distinct, you know? Like, one could have a mustache and one doesn't. You know, you can, you know, one has, like, long hair and one, you know, is bald or whatever. You know, there's things you could do just physically to differentiate them, and which is, you know, completely legitimate way to go. I think we settled on making them sort of similar, like real twins, although we knew from the start that their personalities were very distinct. And the mustache, that sort of was just a practical thing, because there's one thing that I hate, and I'm sure most actors hate, is like glued on facial hair. It's even worse than just like facial prosthetics, like I wore in Disaster Artist. Like, I had 2.5 hours of prosthetics in the Disaster Artist. That was not nearly as bad as just a fake mustache. And so we decided that they would both have mustaches so that I could just grow a mustache and they would both have it. And then we just decided, you know, you'll be able to just tell the characters apart by their personalities. Mm-hmm. And as an actor, it was like, and maybe as a slight egomaniac or whatever, like, it was a dream come true. And I thought of it almost as getting to play the Harvey Keitel and the De Niro roles from Mean Street. You know,
absolutely. I thought of the De Niro character in Mean Streets right away when I saw.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And then you have a great shot in the first episode. It's a totally Taxi Driver shot where you're walking down the street, and all these like marquees are behind you. Like, that's the poster for Taxi Driver.
Oh yeah.
So you directed 2 episodes of The Deuce, and in one of the episodes, there's a scene in which the Maggie Gyllenhaal character, she plays a sex worker, a prostitute, is trying to transition into actually making pornography because it seems like safer and more lucrative and way more interesting and comfortable. And so,
yeah, I mean,
the question is, as part of your research, did you have to like go back and watch a lot of period porn just to get a sense of like, what is it these characters are making? What is it they're watching? What's like the sex environment of the time?
Yeah. It's the early days of American porn. Deep Throat was, you know, obviously the big hit and kind of was the birth of the American porn industry. In the early days, compared to now, it was sort of innocent. There was a bubbliness to it. There was a, you know, and they were trying to tell stories, and something like Deep Throat did play in more mainstream cinemas. And so, you know, they learn things like, you know, it's mostly a male audience. Cut the guy's head out. Don't show the guy's face, you know, and all these things, and cut out the story. People don't want the story. Just cut to the, you know, the juice. And sorry for that, no pun intended, and that kind of thing. But yeah, at the time, you know, the early 70s, and there's a lot of hair, a lot of pubic hair.
Oh, and chest hair, probably.
Yeah.
Right, different times.
Yeah.
So anything else with your filmmaker's take on the porn of the period? Just like from a filmmaker's point of view, how it looked to you?
I mean, it's shot on film. There's...
As opposed to video.
Yeah. There's hardly any... fake breasts, but you know, the moves are basically the same. It's sort of kind of how it's always been.
Was it kind of confusing when you were directing yourself in 2 different parts in The Deuce?
That was a little bit of a it spun my head a little bit, like basically, you know, playing twins and then directing yourself as twins is, you know, it's just sort of an extension of directing. And the way, you know, Bryan Cranston described it, I worked with him. He's such a great guy. And he said on Breaking Bad when he did it, like, as a director, you're already doing the work. You're breaking down the scenes. You're talking to your cinematographer about how you want to capture it. You understand what you want to get out of each scene. So that by the time you're shooting and you step in front of the camera as an actor, you already are really clear on what you want to get from the scene as a director. And so being the actor is just an extension of that. So then playing twins, you just sort of do that twice over where, you know, surprise, surprise, you know, I'm not actually playing both twins at once. So, like, I go in, block it out as the director, then act it as one twin, and then, you know, make the move to change over from Vincent to Frankie at this time so that the cinematographer is now turning the lights around and they'll be spending enough time so that I can quickly change over to Frankie and not waste any set time and come back and then do the scene from the mm-hmm. other side.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Franco, and he stars in the HBO series The Deuce. Season one is over, but you can watch it on demand. And also, he directed and stars in the new film, The Disaster Artist. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from 23andMe, a personalized genetic service dedicated to helping people learn what their 23 pairs of chromosomes say about their health, traits, and ancestry. Learn more at 23andMe.com. And from Hanes, donating 200,000 pairs of socks to those in need and more than 2.1 million pairs since 2009. Information about a day in the life of a person experiencing homelessness at Hanes.com/sock drive.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is James Franco. He starred as two characters in the HBO series The Deuce, and now he stars in and directed the new movie The Disaster Artist, which is basically the behind-the-scenes story of the midnight cult film The Room. So I want to ask you about your movie from a few years ago, The Interview, because it seems very timely, sadly, right now. In The Interview, you played a celebrity journalist, and mm-hmm. you host a program. And as
I was playing one of you.
That's right.
That character, Dave Skarlak, in The Interview is sort of like the Tommy Wiseau. Like, me to Tommy Wiseau is you to Dave Skarlak.
That's really funny. So it turns out Kim Jong-un is a fan, or so he says.
Yes.
And
yes.
So he invites your character, Dave Skarlak, to interview him. And so Dave Skarlak thinks, like, this is my ticket to, like, big-time
yes.
journalism. I'm going to do it.
Yes.
And Seth Rogen is his producer. He's a little skeptical of, you know. But they go and they do it. And meanwhile, the CIA says, and while you're there, assassinate Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
Here's some ricin. You could just slip it when you shake his hand and assassinate
yes.
him with that. Because it's that poisonous.
Yes.
And so what happens instead is that your character has this kind of like bromance with Kim Jong-un. They spend the day together and they play basketball and they drink margaritas and they hang out with attractive women. And
They sing Katy Perry.
They
together.
Sing a Katy Perry song and they have a great time together. So your character doesn't want to assassinate Kim Jong-un because he's so kind of smitten with him.
So silly.
But in the end, he realizes that the whole thing is a facade and Kim Jong-un is a bad
yeah.
man. And the assassination happens. We see his head or his whole body explode. I forget which.
Yeah, both, I think.
Meanwhile, North Korea's reaction to this, Kim Jong-un's actual reaction to the release of the movie is, do not release it or mm-hmm. there will be trouble. And yeah. There were threats against theaters. There were threats to Sony.
Sony was hacked. I guess we still don't know officially.
North
Korea or not.
Exactly.
But Sony was hacked. Yeah.
Exactly. But I think we were basically told it was pretty much North Korea, and Sony basically released it as a video on demand thing, so that people wouldn't have to, feel like they were risking their lives to see it in a theater. This whole time, throughout that whole period, I was thinking, what is going through James Franco and Seth Rogen's minds? So I can ask you now, what was going through your mind during that period when all this really bad stuff was happening attached to the movie? It's a comedy. It's funny. It's a comedy.
It's bizarre. Yeah, it was so bizarre. And I think, we'll go down in Hollywood history. I mean, being in the middle of that was, as you can imagine, confusing. Seth and I were sort of in the dark for a while. Like, nobody was telling us what decisions they were going to make. We were sort of learning things as they came out in headlines. And then, so we learned, they're pulling the movie from the theaters and all this stuff. And so I was sort of in the dark. And then I went home for the holidays. I was staying in a hotel with my grandma, and every morning we'd have breakfast together, and there's a TV in the hotel, and it would inevitably, something about the interview would come up. And then one day it was like Obama came out and made a statement, and he said, they should play it in the theaters. Don't be, back down. We don't back down to threats like this. And he said, and it was my big moment, he said, and I love Seth Rogen. I love James Flacco. I was like, no, it's Franco, no. And I keep hoping, maybe this is the interview with the great Terry Gross that Obama will actually hear and come out and say, okay, it's James Franco. I made a mistake.
But were you feeling, oh my God, is this my fault? Is the hack my fault? Like, if people are hurt?
Well, it was such a tricky thing. And that's what people were, I think even like Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney came out and said, you need to watch this. I don't think they had seen the interview at this point. Maybe they wouldn't have said this, but they're like, you need to watch this movie as your patriotic duty. And, so it was a really confusing, and Clooney, a lot of people were coming out and saying, keep it in theaters. This is, we don't back down.
Mm-hmm.
And became a really strange thing. And there was a point before we made the movie where we were saying like, okay, should we make it the real guy? Should we use the name Kim Jong-un? Or should we just sort of suggest it's the guy? And the strange and crazy thing, it's almost like, the disaster artist in this sense, where we weren't really making things up when we were kind of making jokes about North Korea or just showing how it was. Like, that was strangely all based on things we read or things that had come out of reportage that had come out of North Korea. And then, the idea that maybe he's not a great guy, like, I don't think we were going out on a limb there, mm-hmm. Like, these threats of nuclear war, like, I don't know if we were going out on a limb. It was sort of like, maybe somebody should sort of make a comment on this. Like, making no comparison in like, movie making, skill or anything like that. But, Dr. Strangelove is a comedy about nuclear war, mm-hmm. like atomic war. Like, I felt like, we were falling in that tradition. What I thought was, we're doing what comedy does best. We are slipping you a pill coated in candy. Except that then it became this much bigger thing. It was supposed to be, this sort of comedy that had political, underpinnings. Instead, it just became completely political, and I think that prevented people from really actually seeing the movie for what it was. Because I think it's a great comedy.
I think it's really funny. The only question I'd have about where should the line be is at the end when we see Kim Jong-un actually kind of blow up, like get blown up, blown apart. And maybe I was just wondering,
maybe that was the, bridge too far.
Yeah, I was wondering if you ever had any second thoughts about that.
I mean, there were second thoughts. You can read about all of it in the Sony hack. Like, the original cut had his face exploding in a much more gruesome, explicit way. And then the one concession was, and this is long before the Sony hack, but you can just read about it in the emails of the Sony hack, that they had to cover his face exploding with like flames so that it wasn't as gruesome. But you know what, Terry, maybe you're right. Maybe that was the step too far. I don't know. I kind of doubt that anything would have happened differently with this hack if he didn't get killed. I kind of doubt that, but maybe that was too far. I don't know.
So here's my other question. Did it make you feel the kind of like the power of movies, the unintended power of movies? Did it make you think about movies in any different way than you'd ever thought about them before? Just in terms of like...
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I always believe in the power of movies. And in a basic sense, like what I think they can do and what I always try to do, because I don't normally make... political movies. I mean, not that I'm against them. Like, one of my favorite movies is All the President's Men, but they show us to ourselves, you know, like Shakespeare said, you're holding up the mirror to life. That's my favorite thing about movies. But then, you know, something like Brokeback Mountain or, you know, a movie I was a part of, Milk, like, it starts to turn the consciousness of the country. You know, what art does the best, like understand another, understand somebody who's different than us. When it does that, that's, you know, also so beautiful. And that's what literature does. That's what all great art does. And then in the case of The Interview, that's, you know, it's crazy. It's unprecedented in the history of movies like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. James Franco, it's just been wonderful to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
I love it so much, and I remember all of our interviews, and I hope we can do more.
James Franco directed and stars in the new movie, The Disaster Artist. After we take a short break, linguist Jeff Nunberg will tell us his word of the year. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has chosen his word of the year. We'll let Jeff tell you what it is and why he picked it.
It's word of the year time again. Collins Dictionaries chose fake news, and Dictionary.com went with complicit. Others have proposed hashtag Me Too, alternative facts, take a knee, resistance, and snowflake. It's striking how many of those are the words and phrases that warring political camps have been hurling at each other across our deepening national divide. The Trump presidency didn't create that rift, but it sort of made it official. The acrimonious climate has ruined a lot of Thanksgivings. As two economists recently demonstrated, using cell phone tracking data, they found that Americans from politically divided families spent 20 minutes less time at the holiday dinner table after the election than the year before. Wonkish terms like hyperpolarization don't begin to convey that sense of unrelenting rancor. Instead, the meme of the moment is to say that American politics has become tribal, which I'll make my word of the year. It's not a new word even in that meaning, but in one form or another, it's become the ubiquitous diagnosis for most of our political ills. America's cursed with tribal morality. Tribalism is responsible for fake news and for our inability to confront sexual harassment. Meanwhile, people abroad raise the specter of the new tribalism wherever the traditional nation-state seems to be fraying at the seams, from Catalonia to Scotland. The word tribe is a little problematic, even in its traditional sense, as the primordial social group that predates the nation-state, united by kinship, language, and rituals. Tribe has a legal status in the U.S., and there's nothing pejorative in using it for the Chippewa or Hopi. But indigenous peoples in other parts of the world object to the word's connotations of superstition, backwardness, and savagery. Organizations like UNESCO stopped using tribe some years ago in favor of terms like nation or ethnic group. But of course, it's precisely those savage ooga-booga stereotypes that make tribes so evocative when you attach it to the political groups of modern societies. It suggests that their members have regressed to a more primitive social level, where they're motivated only by their bond with their own kind and their hostility to outsiders. At the limit, the story goes, they're driven purely by primal emotions of fear and rage, which bubble up from the evolutionary depths of what people like to call the lizard brain. With the exception of a few white supremacists, most Americans think tribalism is a bad idea, which is why the word's so often preceded by ugly or toxic. Where we disagree is in actually identifying the tribes. To a lot of people, political tribalism suggests those red and blue family members glowering at each other across the holiday dinner table, impatient to hurry back to their bubbles. They're people whose partisan identities become so central that it determines whom they're willing to date and what brands of pizza and coffee makers they buy, not to mention which news stories they're willing to believe. But for others, tribalism is just another name for identity politics, though which identities count as tribal depends on your point of view. A Wall Street Journal editorial inveighs against what it calls the crude political tribalism of the groups on the left who are trying to divide Americans by race, ethnicity, and gender. But it gives a pass to other groups who tend to vote Republican, like white evangelicals. Yet writers on both the left and right have said that white evangelical has become more of a tribal identity than a theological one. The fact is that however people map out the geography of American political tribes, they always exempt themselves and their neighbors. In modern America, we don't think of our own political allegiances as tribal. We're the creatures of reason. That gives the word a kind of incantatory power. Calling a group tribal is just a way of pronouncing them impervious to rational discussion. Or as one political blogger put it, there's no reasoning with a reptile. There's virtually no phenomenon in public life that someone hasn't tried to discredit as tribal. A writer in National Review blames left tribalism for creating the myth of rape culture. Senator Jeff Flake says it's political tribalism for Republicans to support Roy Moore. Business consultants argue that it's the tribalism of corporate white males that keeps women and minorities out of the executive suite. But Andrew Sullivan sees feminist tribalism behind Google's efforts to hire more women engineers. The Guardian's John Abraham writes that the Republicans' tribalism has led them to deny human-caused climate change. But according to the Wall Street Journal's Holman Jenkins, it's the tribalism of progressives that leads them to refuse to debate the question. Who wouldn't find this maddening? People use tribal to obliterate the differences between solidarity and blind group loyalty, between principled concern and reflexive rage, between the cerebral cortex and the brainstem. But this isn't surprising. If we can't see eye to eye on who are the political tribes and who are the forces of civilization, it's because we're fragmented into factions that deny one another's legitimacy. That's what it means to say that America's become tribal in the first place. And one sign of that is that we can't agree on how to use the word.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California Berkeley School of Information. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about the Mueller investigation. What are the possible charges against the president? What approach is the president's legal team taking? Our guest will be Jeffrey Toobin, who's writing a book about the investigation and has been covering it for The New Yorker, where he's a staff writer, and CNN, where he's chief legal analyst. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with local home improvement professionals for a variety of home projects, from repairs to remodels. Homeowners can read reviews of background-checked pros and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com.